Let me just get to this. And I'm not going to have any slides, but the text of this as text I'll make available electronically to Jeremy and presumably all of you. And you're welcome to use it for whatever purposes you might like. As you know, I chose for my topic today a revisitation of T.S. Kuhn's landmark work, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. I rather suspect many of you have read it, and if so, most probably as an assigned reading in your preparation for a career in science. It was published in 1962 by the University of Chicago as a volume in the, quote, International Encyclopedia of Unified Science, a project that was never, in fact, actually completed. I'm not a scientist, and I don't think of myself as one. Almost all of you are, and you no doubt think of yourselves as scientists. As such, I will attempt to talk about science, but I disclaim that I've earned any right to do so, which is a way of saying thank you for your invitation. I am myself 37 days older than the National Science Foundation, and I have a deep respect for what Public Law 81507 created the NSF to do, which in full is this: to promote the progress of science, to advance the national health, prosperity, and welfare, to secure the national defense, and other purposes. Kuhn's book, which he consistently referred to as an essay, is basically about what science is, based on the observables of what science does and has done. Between him, his supporters, and his critics, which include many noted philosophers, what science is to this day unsettled at its core. Perhaps that is why both Kuhn's supporters and his critics agree on one thing, that there is no algorithm to science. I come at this question, the question of what is science, and later in this essay, whether cybersecurity can or has become a science, with a set of biases formed by how I was myself taught. For the record, I'm the son of a certified public accountant. I spent my youth checking adding machine tapes, and was subsequently formally trained first as an electrical engineer, and then further as a biostatistician. To the extent that one can assess one's own biases, mine are that while numbers are endlessly fascinating, they are not to be sought for their own sake, but rather for the purpose of decision support. Medicine, where I worked for 15 years, has a term of art that encapsulates that very idea. The term is no therapeutic difference, meaning that if a blood test or a scan or what have you might improve the subtle precision of a subtle diagnosis, if the therapy would nevertheless be the same, then the pursuit of further diagnostic precision is not medicine, but something else. As we say on the security metrics mailing list, I am a modeler, I'm a measurer, not a modeler. But biases aside, I think the time has come to read Kuhn's essay in the context of cybersecurity. He begins and ends with what is a circular idea, that a scientific community is defined by what beliefs practitioners share, and what beliefs practitioners share defines what community they are in. This is, in fact, instructive, as no science begins in mature form, but rather any new science will begin in much more modest circumstances where, in fact, there is nothing approaching a consensus in any sense of the word, that early on, consensus is not even a concept. As such, part of becoming a mature science is the development of a broad consensus about the core concerns of that branch of knowledge. Kuhn's word for the collection of exemplars of good science was paradigm, a word whose meaning today is all but entirely Kuhn's, even amongst those who never read a blessed word he wrote. Anyone who hails from Berkeley or Madison or Cambridge will remember the bumper sticker that said, "Subvert the dominant paradigm," and can thus attest to the impact of Kuhn's propositions bundled up in that one word, even to anarchists. But what is a paradigm, and why do we want one? As Kuhn puts it, paradigms are the source of the methods, the problem field, and the standards of solution accepted by any mature scientific community at any given time. Kuhn's book and the two-decade-long back and forth between Kuhn and philosophers notwithstanding, the simplest version is simply that a paradigm is all the things that a scientist can assume that his or her colleagues will congenially understand about their common work without explicitly explaining them and arguing them from first principles again and again. Several authors besides Kuhn have adopted that idea to explain the proliferation of jargon as being something that markedly improves the efficiency of communication between practitioners who do, in fact, share a paradigm, who share a sense of technique, who have a set of trainings, who have a worldview in common. As Kuhn said, although it is customary and is surely proper to deplore the widening gulf that separates the professional scientist from his colleagues in other fields, too little attention is paid to the essential relationship between that gulf and the mechanisms intrinsic to scientific advance. In other words, impenetrable jargon between scientists sharing a paradigm is a side effect of that sharing and a tool of efficiency because it insulates science from society. But, I hear you say, any field from poetry to American history to macroeconomics can have an impenetrable jargon. Does that make those fields sciences? Clearly not. And here is where Kuhn's paradigm, where his construct is central. In a science, the shared paradigm is universal, whereas in the humanities, say, there are always competing schools of thought that are unlikely to ever sign some unifying intellectual peace treaty. As Kuhn would have it, a paradigm, a shared framework for how the world works, is the engine for creating the kind of puzzles that individual scientists are able to solve if only they work hard enough. The paradigm creates general agreement amongst those who hold it as to where further research is needed. When a body of scientists is asked, where should research go next? The answer will be the same as to the question, where is research going? Because the shared paradigm makes it so. And note that I used Kuhn's word puzzles rather than problems. Kuhn is at some pains to make clear that a scientist doing science is solving the puzzles that the paradigm leaves open to solution. He or she is not solving problems in the vernacular sense of the word problem. Again, quoting Kuhn, men whose research is based on shared paradigms are committed to the same rules and standards for scientific practice. That commitment and the apparent consensus it produces are prerequisites for normal science, i.e., for the genesis and continuation of a particular research tradition. Acquisition of a paradigm and of the more esoteric type of research it permits is a sign of maturity in the development of any given scientific field. Science is about knowledge, knowledge derived from experiment, whether those experiments are designed or natural. And the refinement of knowledge is to be ultimately found in quantification. But though the ability to explicitly quantify is a sign of agreement on terms and processes, the ability to quantify is not itself proof that the body of knowledge involved is of a scientific sort. The ability to quantify is necessary, but not sufficient. To be blunt, no less a person than Nassim Taleb, Fool by Randomness, The Black Swan, said this of economics: you can disguise its charlatanism under the weight of equations, and nobody can catch you since there's no such thing as a controlled experiment. Competing schools of thought are, however, always present before immature science first appears. As Kuhn said, what is surprising and perhaps also unique in its degree to the fields we call science is that such initial competing schools should ever largely disappear. For they do disappear to a very considerable extent, and then apparently once and for all. Perhaps it is thus possible to say that topics of study that never coalesce their competing schools are either fated never to be sciences or in some state of arrested development that may someday be cured. Those that can and will, but have not yet done so, are what Kuhn called pre-paradigmatic, meaning not yet a science. The appearance of a paradigm that all can accept is when the transition to being a science occurs, or as Kuhn put it, except with the advantage of hindsight, it is hard to find another criterion that so clearly proclaims a field has become a science. For Kuhn, the appearance of a paradigm transforms those who merely study, first into a discipline and then into a profession, even if, as the science develops its thought processes, its language becomes ever less intelligible to non-specialists. One can even say, and Kuhn does, that the paradigm itself is the last result of the science in question that can be appreciated by the lay audience. After that, all progress is in journal articles, not read by non-specialists, enough so that the scientist who writes for the lay reader is more likely to find his professional reputation impaired than advanced for having done so. Now, as everyone here knows, from time to time a science may undergo a revolution, which in Kuhn's term is precisely the laying down of one paradigm in preference for another. The title of his book is to be understood as precisely that, that scientific revolutions share aspects of structure that we can now describe as there have been enough of them in the last 400 years to discern that structure. If you consider physics to be the paragon of a hard science, then the transition from Newtonian mechanics to Einsteinian relativity demonstrates exactly the point Kuhn was making, that there comes a point where research has reached a kind of impasse where the nature of what now look to be problems needing further study cannot be profitably investigated within the paradigm that then holds. Kuhn referred to these impasses as the appearance of an anomaly, one that the existing paradigm cannot evaluate by way of further research consistent with the paradigm itself. His review of past revolutions centered in each case on the appearance of irreconcilable anomalies that made a given field ripe for revolution. For example, that roasting metals caused them to gain weight, thus indicating that they had absorbed some fraction of the air around them, a fraction that could be exhausted, led to the idea that air might not be the one and only gas, but rather a combination of gases. Perhaps more significantly to the very idea of revolution, is that even though Lavoisier had discovered oxygen, others in the field, notably Priestley, never accepted the existence of oxygen and held to the phlogiston theory to the end of their careers. I say more significantly, as the trite version of what is a scientific revolution is that it is a time when newcomers to the field adopt the new paradigm, while those already in the field slowly die off. It is generational change. The first and perhaps main objection to Kuhn's thesis was that it implied a certain irrationality to the advancement of science, that science and scientists did not, despite what textbooks tend to say, advance in a monotonic way under the self-imposed discipline of rationality. Kuhn's implication that scientific advance is not necessarily rational, but may occasionally be irrational, is found by many to be unacceptable. I'm not going to argue that point here, as the essay is not about the history of science, but I will quote George Bernard Shaw. The reasonable man adapts himself to the world, the unreasonable man persists in trying to adapt the world to himself, therefore all progress depends on the unreasonable man. This is not to say that a newer paradigm must be uniformly better than its predecessor, only that it account for the heretofore irreconcilable anomalies that scientists have found with the older paradigm. Ptolemaic Earth-centric astronomy explained the motion of the planets pretty well, but its complexity began to increase far more rapidly than its accuracy, thus a crisis and a ripeness for a new paradigm. Kuhn observed that a proliferation of competing theories is the concomitant of a crisis, and it is the new paradigm that resolves that crisis. He goes on to say that so long as the tools a paradigm supplies continue to prove capable of solving the problems it defines, science moves fastest and penetrates most deeply through confident employment of those tools. The reason is clear. As in manufacture, so in science. Retooling is an extravagance to be reserved for the occasion that requires it. The significance of crises is the indication they provide that an occasion for retooling has arrived. Kuhn's idea of crisis is the dual of his idea of paradigm. Where a paradigm suggests puzzles that further research will solve, in a crisis, this is not so. Yet the occasional crisis is itself necessary for advancement, as any paradigm whose theories completely explain all observable fact ceases to be science and becomes engineering. In other words, the crisis is not the end of research, but the substitution of new paradigm for old and a new set of research puzzles awaiting solution. Just as a scientific theory is declared invalid only if an alternate candidate is available to take its place, to reject one paradigm without simultaneously substituting another is to reject science itself. In short, when an anomaly appears, there are only three resolutions available. One, solve the problem. Two, leave the problem for future scientists. Or three, use the crisis to force a new paradigm onto the field. One can almost hear Rahm Emanuel's political dictum to never let a good crisis go to waste in some sort of parallel to Kuhn. When there is a shift of paradigm, that is to say, a scientific revolution, it may serve to redirect a field so completely that some parts of it fall away entirely. The separation of astronomy from astrology, or the separation of chemistry from physics, to pick two examples. As Kuhn put it, the choice between paradigms is a choice between incompatible modes of community life. And yes, he does mean scientific community in an altogether social sense. Since no two paradigms leave all the same problems unsolved, paradigm debates involve the question, which problems is it more significant to have solved? Kuhn also views the education and apprenticeship of a new scientist as the propagation of the field's paradigms to the new scientist such that he or she can join the professional scientific community. Here he argues with how that is done by saying, textbooks refer only to that part of the work of past scientists that can easily be viewed as contributions to the statements and solutions of the text's paradigmatic problems. In other words, the supposed linearity and unbroken advance in a field that is the typical narrative of textbook writing is wrong. Rather, it is that science is cumulative only within the sway of a particular paradigm, only within the sway of a particular paradigm. Scientists are not, of course, the only group that tends to see its disciplines past developing linearly toward the present vantage. The temptation to write history backward is both omnipresent and perennial. But scientists are more affected by the temptation to rewrite history, partly because the results of scientific research show no obvious dependence upon the historical context of the inquiry, and partly because, except during crises and revolution, the scientist's contemporary position seems so secure. Alfred North Whitehead said as much, "A science that hesitates to forget its founders is lost." Though Kuhn goes to some length to call that process reinterpretation rather than forgetting. Though with the same result, namely that scientific progress is not linear, even if every textbook speaks of standing on the shoulders of giants. It is tempting to analogize science as a kind of biologic process. The noted paleobiologist Stephen Jay Gould famously coined the term punctuated equilibrium to describe the fossil record, saying that there would naturally be long periods of stasis followed by much shorter periods of rapid change. He wrote, "The history of life is not a continuum of development, but a record punctuated by brief, sometimes geologically instantaneous episodes of mass extinction and subsequent diversification." Extending Gould, Matthew Stone King considers scientific revolutions to be quite similar to extinction events, and more importantly, the diversifying speciation that follows an extinction event. In this, Stone King and Kuhn diverge and that Stone King sees scientific speciation as a consequence of revolution, where Kuhn sees proliferating species, that is to say theories, as the precipitating event just prior to a revolution. Stone King goes on to say, if all members of a species were identical in all features, then the species would be extremely vulnerable to even minor changes in the environment. As it is, when the environment changes, there are usually members of the species who are better suited to survive under the new conditions. The offspring of those individuals tend to be more numerous and better able to compete for resources than the offspring of other members of the species. The analogy to periods of normal scientific activity are crude, but they fit pretty well. During periods of normal science, members of a given discipline adopt the paradigm theory to fit observation in as many specific cases as possible. The outcome of that work is a better articulated paradigm, one that works better in a wider range of phenomena. During periods of normal science, the paradigm evolves in a smooth way, in a way analogous to the minor adaptations of species to short-term changes in the environment. In other words, Stone King is arguing that Gould and Kuhn are of the same view, that scientific communities and scientific disciplines are species, that linguistic isolation within such communities serve the purpose of reproductive isolation, that interdisciplinary fields have the characteristics of biologic hybrids, both as to vigor and to reproductive infidelity, that a scientific community in crisis corresponds to an impending extinction event, and that scientific revolutions are speciation events. I think he pushed that a bit too far. As with Kuhn, I don't see a scientific revolution as speciation, but rather speciation events as the prodrome of an extinction event. That is to say, an event where survival of the fittest is then coldly demonstrated. What Kuhn does see, though, is this. Science surely grows in depth, though it may not grow in breadth as well. If it does, that breadth is manifested mainly in the proliferation of scientific specialities, not in the scope of any single specialty alone. And to round out Kuhn, the single most controversial part of his analysis is that science is not, despite pretensions to the contrary, unperturbed by the social milieu in which it operates. For Kuhn, science cannot be the search for ultimate truth, which he makes clear when he says, we may have to relinquish the notion, explicit or implicit, that changes of paradigm carry scientists and those who learn from them closer and closer to the truth. It is his conclusion that science is undirected, and that offends the sensibilities of many scientists. Kuhn's discussion of aesthetic qualities, such as theoretic elegance, elaborates this further, which Brian Greene, a separate author, reinforces, writing that it is certainly the case that some decisions made by theoretical physicists are founded upon an aesthetic sense, a sense of which theories have an elegance and beauty of structure on a par with the elegance and beauty of structure in the world we experience. Of course, nothing ensures that this strategy leads toward truth. I would like to now turn toward cybersecurity. I use the term cybersecurity in lieu of the many alternatives, perhaps because I work alongside the governmental policy community, where the word cybersecurity resonates and has become a term of both art and of funding. If you prefer information security or computer security or something else again, please hear those phrases and don't let my choice of terms derail the rest of this talk. One of the first questions we might ask is whether cybersecurity is a science or not, and if not, whether it ever will be. With several others, I'm one of the expert reviewers for the National Security Agency's annual Science of Security Award, which is actually a competition. Quoting its rationale, the competition was established to recognize the current security paper that best reflects the conduct of good science in the work described. Science of security is a broad enterprise involving both theoretical and empirical work. While there can only be one best paper, any one paper cannot span that full breadth. Nonetheless, the field is broad, and work in all facets is encouraged and needed. The common denominator across the variety of approaches is solid methodology and effective communication. So those aspects of the papers are strong factors in our decision. Papers are nominated for consideration, and I encourage you to nominate some. But I'm also here to report that amongst the reviewers, our views of what constitutes a or the science of security vary rather a lot. Some of us would prioritize purpose, agreeing with Charles Darwin that all observation must be for or against some view if it is to be of any service. Some of us view aspects of methodology as paramount, especially reproducibility and the clarity of communication on which it depends. Some of us are ever on the lookout for what a physicist would call a unifying field theory. Some of us insist that the classic process of hypothesis generation followed by designed experiments. We vary, and I take that to be a vote of sorts on whether cybersecurity is as yet a science. The question of whether cybersecurity is yet a science is, in fact, a hard one. I am sorely tempted to answer the question, is cybersecurity a science, with getting closer, but not yet. To say, in other words, that we are in the pre-paradigmatic change with a variety of schools of thought. I'll return to that later, but let's talk a bit about candidate paradigms for cybersecurity. If they exist and have turned over from time to time, then my answer would be simply wrong. But let me be clear about one thing that may make cybersecurity different than all else, and that is that we have sentient opponents. The physicist does not. The chemist does not. Not even the economist has sentient opponents. We do. What puzzles we have to solve are not drawn from some generally diminishing store of unsolved puzzles, nor do our theories completely explain all observable fact, thus reducing our worries and our work to engineering alone. There is something different about a search for truth when there isn't any, or at least any that lasts long enough to itself be exhaustively explored. And while I view the greatest potential contradiction between cybersecurity and science to be the sentient opponent, it may be that the rate of change of the technical fabric is what is ultimately distinguishing. Perhaps rate of change is a continuum. And when I say that the sentient opponent is the greatest issue, it may just be that the gross rate of change is the sum of technical advance plus sentient opponents, with sentient opponents being the most accelerating fraction over the overall sum we call technologic change. Take one of the most basic tools we employ, that of authentication. Authentication is the solution to the puzzle of identity establishment, a puzzle that derived from the paradigm of perimeter control. For authorization to have meaning, authentication has to come first. And authentication is of necessity established prior to its use in any authorization decision. But this mechanism is the solution to a puzzle consequent to the paradigm in which it has meaning, the paradigm of perimeter control. We came to the idea of perimeter control from the physical world, where walled cities date almost to the time there were any cities at all. Even defense in depth is hardly new. The concentrically walled fort called Dun Angus in Ireland is at least 3,000 years old. With the technologic change that may as well be called the internet, it is only natural that we transpose the paradigm of perimeter control to the digital world. The paradigm of perimeter control has been in an evident crisis for some time now. The crisis is not merely because the definition of perimeter may have been poorly applied in practice, but because some combination of always-on and universal addressability collectively make the paradigm of a defensive perimeter less and less a paradigm where research is itself likely to patch up the mess and retain the core and guiding paradigm of perimeter control. The parallel with Ptolemaic astronomy is pretty fair. On the one hand, every improvement in observational accuracy made the motions of the planets more complicated to describe with epicycles upon epicycles. On the other hand, the threat to systems from always-on universal addressability has become too rich to just to be just a new set of puzzles solely within the paradigm of perimeter control. The defensive perimeter began to have its own version of epicycles within epicycles when it began to shrink, when a perimeter could or should control something became ever smaller. A second crisis for the paradigm of perimeter control is upon us now, and that is perhaps best illustrated by a straight-up commercial example. Let's count the number of cores in the Qualcomm Snapdragon 801. The central CPU is 4 cores. The Adreno 330 GPU, another 4. Video out is 1. The Hexagon QDSP is 3. The modem is at least 2 and most likely 4. Bluetooth is another one, as is the USB controller and the GPS. The Wi-Fi is at least 1 and most likely 2. And none of this includes charging, power, or display. That makes somewhere between 18 and 21 cores. In the vocabulary of the Internet of Things, I ask you whether that is one thing or the better part of 24 things. It is pretty certain that each of those cores can reach the others. So is the perimeter to be defended the physical artifact in the user's pocket, or is it the execution space of each of those cores? I looked at 7 different examples of the growth of the Internet of Things as a market phenomenon. Everything from smart electric meters to networked light bulbs to luxury automobiles. And the median estimate is a compound annual growth of 35%. If perimeter control is to remain the paradigm of cybersecurity, then the number of perimeters to defend in the Internet of Things is doubling every 17 months. If the paradigm of perimeter control is no longer producing puzzles that can be solved by further scientific research, then what? Noting, as Kuhn does, that to reject one paradigm without simultaneously substituting another is to reject science itself. What might be a substitution? Well, while that is for you, the research community, to decide, I'll say that one of the alternates is a mix of surveillance and accountability. If, as seems the case, everything we do or are is unique if expanded and examined closely enough, then the idea of authentication as verifying an assertion like, "My name is Dan," can easily morph into an observable like, "Sensors say that this is Dan." In other words, our paradigm of an authentication transaction before any other perimeter piercing transaction is allowed is itself showing its age. Part of the authentication crisis is a fork in the road that cannot be avoided here, and that is the more authorities you personally command, the more varieties of authentication you have to have, or at least you have had to have up until now. The paradigm that is the obvious alternative to perimeter control and thus authentication as a gating function is accountability based on one single unspoofable identity per person in a world of universal surveillance. If I am right that real soon now identity is an observable that needs no assertions, then that single identity which the individual has but does not need to prove may be fast upon us. The National Strategy for Trusted Identities in Cyberspace is not worded in that way, though that is how I read it. But in fairness, the deliberative writing of national strategies in the face of accelerating change is as hard as providing cybersecurity in the face of accelerating change. Nevertheless, if being part of the modern world is no more robust, if in no more robust way than appearing unmasked on a public street, is the same as submitting to unitary identity observable at a distance by things you never heard of, then for the individual that means either submission or withdrawal. The individual's choice is outside a talk on the science of security, unless in the term security you want to include the latent power of data collected for no particular purpose by an Internet of Things growing at 35% per annum. Note that Kuhn never said that a switch to a new paradigm would be delightful or comforting. He merely said that it would better explain the way the world works, while suggesting new puzzles for scientists who share that paradigm to pursue. Authentication transactions, as a prodrome to authorization transactions, and service of perimeter control may soon be behind us, including in the peer-to-peer world. If, in fact, being authenticated as yourself is unavoidable, then there is no proving that this is the Dan for whom there is a book entry allowing him into some robot-protected building, but rather an accountability regime based on whether that Dan did or did not enter a building for which he might later be penalized. His crime would not be masquerading as some identity other than his own so as to get in, but rather that he was observed to have gone in even though he knew he was forbidden to do so. Let's try another, all but equivalent paradigm, namely that of personal control of personal data. You can argue that it is a little different than the cybersecurity paradigm of perimeter control in the large, but now confined only to the personal and the small. I happen to disagree. If the person is to have free will, then the person has to have, as Eric Hughes put it so long ago, the power to selectively reveal oneself to the world. That is why in my own work I have defined a state of privacy as testable by whether or not you retain the effective capacity to misrepresent yourself. But the paradigm that Eric and I shared is now in substantial crisis because the metadata collection by both government agencies and by advertising agencies means that there is no mechanistic difference whatsoever between personalization and targeting save for intent of the analyst. Daniel Solove's work notwithstanding, the meme of "I have nothing to hide" has captured the field. With self-driving cars and electronic health records and smarter electric grids, there are unprecedented advantages to the individual and to society at large. There's also a crisis of paradigm. In this case, the paradigm is that data to be shared has to be specifically permitted in discrete chunks. Nothing trendy coming to market that I can see from the kinds of startups that passed before me shares that paradigm. Nothing coming from regulatory agencies shares that paradigm. The paradigm of specific permission and discrete chunks is in crisis. It is as if the paradigm has been rejected and a new one adopted based on hope alone. We have known for some time that traffic analysis is more powerful than content analysis. If I know everything about to whom you communicate, including when, where, with what intermessage latency and at what length, from what geolocation and with what device, then I know you. If all I have is the undated, unaddressed text of your messages, then I'm an archaeologist, not a case officer. The soothing mendacity of proxies for the president who said it's only metadata was to rely on the ignorance of the listener. But you here, of course, all know that. What I am suggesting as a crisis around the paradigm of selective revelation is that, as with metadata, there's so much redundancy in what is observable that prohibiting one or another form of collection has zero meaningful effect whatsoever on those agencies, intelligence, or advertising who would build a model of you from metadata alone. As but one example, with current technology, I can read the unique radio signature of your beating heart at 5 meters. As with anything that has an electromagnetic output, the only technologic question is the quality of the antenna. If I am allowed to take your picture on the public street without your permission or notice, why can't I record your heart, or your iris, or your gait, or the difference in temperature between your hands and your face? That list is long and getting longer. It is a crisis for which the paradigm of selective revelation can scarce put up puzzles fast enough, and scientific solving of those puzzles can, at best, trail the curve. So what might be an alternate paradigm, one that can replace the paradigm of selective revelation as a shared worldview and source of research puzzles worth solving for privacy scientists? I will suggest one, and it goes like this. If the citizenry of a democracy choose a path, then that path cannot be wrong. It can only be real. The citizenry has chosen a technical political framework that involves everything from wearable health monitors to self-driving cars to internet-connected thermostats to LoJack for children, and so forth and so on. Again, that cannot be wrong. It merely is. Because the public chooses in that way, the world now admits a set of problems for which science and scientists had better find a generative paradigm. Perhaps what heretofore we have known as confidentiality is becoming quaint and irrelevant. Perhaps science will have to reposition confidentiality within some new paradigm that prioritizes integrity, not confidentiality. Perhaps a world in which data can and will be collected irrespective of selective permission granting is a world in which the data had better be right. If more and more intelligent actors are out there doing our implicit bidding long after we've forgotten the configuration interface that they have, then that data integrity had better be as absolute as we can make it, and that is where the research puzzles will have to be found. If we are to have all electronic health records and regular monitoring by everything from our toilet to the breathalyzer in our cars, all the while the majority of medicines transition to being genomically personalized, we had better be sure that data integrity is paradigmatic. The long-standing triad of confidentiality, integrity, and availability may now be contracted to just integrity and availability. Only this last October, the Santa Fe Institute and Morgan Stanley held a joint symposium entitled "Are Optimization and Efficiency the Enemies of Robustness and Resilience?" So perhaps the crisis is already in some early stage of being made clear. Perhaps I have it wrong. Perhaps the topmost paradigm of the science of security is simply that of defense. Perhaps the rise of sentient opponents makes that paradigm of defense unarguable. Perhaps that is the paradigm, as evidenced by rafts of paradigmatically generated puzzles of the sort of how can this or that be hardened or otherwise defended. If defense is and has been our paradigm, then that too may be in crisis. That is in no way a failure. Paradigms only change due to the success that the one paradigm has in motivating science to explore the world thoroughly enough to discover anomalies that cannot be made to fit within the paradigm that caused them to be discovered in the first place. The outgrowth of the paradigm of defense has been guidance that has allowed us, including non-scientist practitioners, to get better and better. We have discovered and then deployed better tools. We have come to understand causal chains and thus to better understand practices. And by way of the educational byproduct of such researches, we have more and better colleagues. That is the plus side, and it is one terrific plus side. But I am interested in the ratio of skill to challenge. There, as far as I can estimate, we are expanding the society-wide attack surface faster than our science of security is expanding our collection of tools, practices, and colleagues. If your island nation is growing more and better food, that's great. If your population is growing faster than those improvements in food production can keep up, that's bad. Society's adoption curve for new technology looks ever steeper from where I sit. The paradigm of defense is, therefore, in crisis. Part of my feeling stems from a long-held, and I believe well-substantiated view, that all cybersecurity technology is dual use. Perhaps dual use is a truism. Truism for any and all knowledge, as well as any and all tools derived from knowledge, that knowledge can always be used for good or ill. But I am convinced that dual use is inherent in cybersecurity tools. If your definition of tool is wide enough, I suggest that the cybersecurity tool set strongly favors offense, at least these days. Chris Inglis, who recently retired as NSA deputy director, remarked that, quote, if we are to score cyber the way we score soccer, the tally would be 462 to 456 20 minutes into the game. It's all offense. I take his comment as confirming at the highest level not only the dual use of cybersecurity, but also confirming that offense is where the innovations that nation states and only nation states can afford is going on. Does that not change the cybersecurity paradigm? Even if you're not willing to trade in the paradigm of defense for a paradigm of offense, you will at least need to modify the paradigm of defense to something like a paradigm of dual-use cognizant defense. One embodiment of that paradigm of defense has been the movement to build security in. The successes of that movement are precisely of the sort I mentioned before when I said that we have discovered and then deployed better tools. We have come to understand causal chains and thus better to understand practices. And by way of the educational byproduct of such researches, we have more and better colleagues. But to remind you of the truism in Adi Shamir's Turing lecture, cryptography is typically bypassed, not penetrated. I would argue that this is true of all aspects of cybersecurity mechanism, including those delivered by building security in. It is the possibility of bypass that ultimately matters. Our sentient opponents know that too, and their investments in automating the discovery of methods of bypass are in a hell of a horse race with both building security in and in the static analysis of code bodies, whether new or old. I pause here to add that colleagues of mine in the forefront of static analysis report that they are now regularly seeing web applications in excess of 2 gigabytes with 20,000 variables, applications that can only have been written by machine. Yet those too have flaws. Perhaps if the building of security in is to remain an embodiment of the paradigm of defense, there will have to soon be research puzzles addressing how to prevent machines from writing vulnerabilities. As with other paradigms in crisis, the crisis would be vacuous if there were not at least the possibility of a paradigm to replace the one that is creating and thus confronting its own anomalies. A specific one that I feel holds some promise is the work going on at UPenn by Clark et al. On what they call the honeymoon effect. In rough terms, they quantify the degree to which sentient opponents require non-zero time to exploit new code and, in turn, how to simply outrun those opponents. And in so doing, also quantify how code reuse reduces the labor of exploit. Is that an alternative paradigm to defense, at least to the embodiment of defense in the form of hardening deployed systems? Well, time will tell. But I believe that an alternative paradigm could be in the running, though, as we all recognize, constant code churn is fundamentally inconsistent with compliance and certification. The paradigm of defense had a similar challenge some years ago under a different regime of tight coding, namely the transition whereby Microsoft in particular adopted address space layout randomization, or ASLR, to thwart in particular the problem of buffer overflows. Perhaps moving target defense should be classified in a similar way, namely a new solution to the puzzle of how to prevent exploitability. I think it goes beyond that, but that is an arguable nuance, at least for now. But both randomization of code bodies at runtime and moving target by way of rapid release embody Einstein's wisdom encapsulated in his famous remark that insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. Where we are losing, we have to change the rules of the game. Just bearing down is to make adding epicycles to Ptolemaic equations the kind of puzzles we find ourselves solving. Speaking from my engineering bias per se, for me, the pinnacle goal of cybersecurity engineering is that of no silent failure. Failure is to be avoided wherever possible, but absolute total avoidance is sure to be diseconomic and not of interest in the already deployed world. Silent failure is, however, pandemic. The Verizon Data Breach Investigations Report has time and again found that 80% of all data breaches are discovered not by the victim, but by an unrelated third party. With a colleague in New York and the finance community, we run the Index of Cybersecurity. It's a survey. And in that, we once asked whether the respondent had ever discovered a data breach of another firm besides his or her own. We got 55% yes with confirmation and 10% yes but unconfirmed. Since we exclude law enforcement from our index's catchment, our 65% and Verizon's 80% can be said to be in close agreement. There is a lot of silent failure going on. As you well know, the lay press regularly reports silent failures of data protection in the retail sector. But is it not likely that the more severe the data protection failure, the more likely it is to be silent? That is to say, still silent? Is it not likely that the next major breach will be bigger than the ones that came before? Plot them on a curve. That's all I can say. I was taught a long time ago, but the rule of thumb I learned then was that for a large code base, a substantial portion, I was taught 40% of it, should be in exception handling. I now interpret thoroughgoing attention to exception handling as the avoidance of silent failure. Perhaps that is the change of paradigm that is needed to ensure not that code cannot and will not fail, but that its failure will not be silent. Certainly the language theoretic security work going on at Dartmouth and elsewhere has a similar view, and it too has promise if indeed the crisis in code security is severe enough to require a new paradigm consistent with the idea of no silent failure. The core sentence in their manifesto is that the only path to trustworthy software that takes untrusted inputs is treating all valid or expected inputs as a formal language and the respective input handling routines as a recognizer for that language. The recognizer must be feasible, and the recognizer must match the language in required computation power. That is what an alternate paradigm sounds like. Whether it is one or not, I leave to you. Kuhn takes some pains to say why it is that a paradigm shift requires a crisis. That is that, to an extent unparalleled in other fields, scientists have undergone similar educations and professional initiations. One here must ask the central question of this essay by mirroring Kuhn: are the paradigms of cybersecurity in enough of a crisis that resolution of the crisis requires a change of paradigm? The answer is by no means obvious, though to my eye, there is a crisis, or rather several crises, now in play. If the crisis is, or the crises are, sufficient to require a reformulation of the paradigm or paradigms of cybersecurity, then a scientific revolution is upon us, what Kuhn calls a reconstruction of group commitments. As he points out, a crisis requiring such a reconstruction may not even be in cybersecurity itself, but instead due to discoveries in some other field or venue, just as discoveries in physics engendered a crisis that upended chemistry once upon a time. On the other hand, perhaps I'm being too hard on cybersecurity. Perhaps it is already more mature than I give it credit for. In Kuhn's analysis, a mature science has a relative scarcity of competing schools. Members of the scientific community provide the only audience for and judges of what constitutes puzzles worth solving. And puzzle solving is the principal activity in which those scientists are engaged. In such a situation, scientific knowledge is intrinsically the common property of the group, or else nothing at all. Certainly not everyone agrees with that characterization, not even with the idea of puzzle solving. Professor Peter Drucker, an economist, famously said, "Don't solve problems, create opportunities." While that is not research, might we consider the paradigm crisis to be the kind of problem for which the formulation of a new paradigm creates opportunity? Or take Francis Bacon: truth emerges more readily from error than from confusion. Are we at a point of either error or confusion? And if so, is the reconstruction of what we are about become timely? Kuhn's analysis was, of necessity, grounded in the history of several centuries of science. Perhaps he agreed with Winston Churchill that the further back we look, the further forward we can see. But the centuries that both Kuhn and Churchill absorbed may be misleading in a world of accelerating change. Kuhn maintained over and over that science is not linear, not some steady upslope at 8% grade. Gould said the same thing, but about biologic evolution. One can only assume that the science of security will inevitably experience periods of relative stasis, what Kuhn called normal science, equilibria punctuated by periods of rapid change. What if rapid change becomes a constant? What if the periods of expansion and consolidation of what a paradigm allows us to scientifically evaluate become too short for thoroughly exploiting what our then current paradigm empowers us to do? Normal science does not aim for novelties, not for novelties of fact or of theory, and when successful, it finds none. Let me quote a longer passage that challenges us, I believe, in particular. In the development of any science, the first received paradigm is usually felt to account quite successfully for most of the observations and experiments easily accessible to that science's then practitioners. Further development, therefore, ordinarily calls for the construction of elaborate equipment, the development of an esoteric vocabulary and skills, and a refinement of concepts that increasingly lessen their resemblance to their usual common sense properties. That professionalization leads, on the one hand, to an immense restriction of the scientist's vision and to a considerable resistance to paradigm change. The science becomes increasingly rigid. On the other hand, within those areas to which the paradigm directs the attention of the group, normal science leads to a detail of information and to a precision of the observation to theory match that can be achieved in no other way. Furthermore, that detail and precision of match has a value that transcends their not always very high intrinsic interest. Without the special apparatus that is constructed mainly for anticipated functions, the results that lead ultimately to novelty cannot occur. And even when the apparatus exists, novelty emerges only for the scientist who, knowing with precision what he or she should expect, is able to recognize that something has gone wrong. Anomaly appears only against the background provided by the paradigm. The more precise and far-reaching that paradigm is, the more sensitive an indicator it provides of anomaly and hence of an occasion for paradigm change. In the normal mode of discovery, even resistance to change has a use. By ensuring that the paradigm will not be too easily surrendered, resistance guarantees that scientists will not be lightly disturbed, and that the anomalies that lead to paradigm change will penetrate existing knowledge to the core. The very fact that a scientific novelty so often emerges simultaneously from several laboratories is an index both to the strongly traditional nature of normal science and to the completeness with which that traditional pursuit prepares the way for its own change. That then is the question that is before us, complicated by the changing nature of what scientists of security are studying, both with respect to rapid technologic change and the presence of sentient opponents, leavened, of course, with the societal demands fast upon us, largely independent of what we know or say. I think I see paradigms here that are, or soon will be, an undeniable crisis. I can, of course, be entirely wrong. Perhaps I should hope for that. And we may still be working our way up to being a science, still coalescing schools of thought into the kind of paradigm that will define us all as scientists. Perhaps some one of you or of your colleagues is already further down the track of applying Kuhn or something like it to the science of security. If so, I'm eager to hear all about it. That I do not know about it, despite it being already well underway, is merely my error. And as quoted above, perhaps one of you will teach me what that error has made me receptive for. To close with a single line from the musical Gigi, have I been standing up too close? or back too far. There's never enough time. Thank you for yours.